Hello, everybody, and welcome to Climate Hour. I'm Sky Hawthorne.
And I'm Samuel Marcus, and we're your hosts today.
This episode of Climate Hour is brought to you by ExxonMobil.
ExxonMobil. Without them, there'd be no need to talk about climate change.
All right. So today we are very fortunate to have on Gabrielle Antonioli.
Please forgive us if we've mispronounced that. Gabrielle is an avalanche forecaster in Montana who's worked Bridger National Forest, and is currently working in Glacier National Park, a grad student at Montana State working on snow science, and a friend of my friend Phoebe's, I think the easiest way to say it, an all-around badass. We're very excited to welcome her to the pod.
Yeah, that nailed it. Other than the badass part, we can take that part off. I don't feel that way, but thank you.
You know, you may not feel that way, but I feel like for us, the best place to begin is just tell us what you did today, because I think that might say otherwise.
So today, I'm working on the Going to the Sun Road in Glacier National Park right now, which has to be plowed every spring, but all the workers have to cross a bunch of avalanche paths that actively avalanche pretty much the entire plow season. So a group of three forecasters, we kind of switch off who's forecasting in the morning, but we put out an in-house morning forecast for the National Park Service, and we go up with the plow crew, which is what I did today. We went to our last spot and we actually brought an anemometer up to a weather station that's up in the Alpine there, around 7,000 feet, and we fixed it and then went skiing and skied out.
What is an anemometer?
Just measuring the intensity and direction of the wind for us in the Alpine, and it's really useful when we're forecasting, you know, 4 or 5 a.m. to be able to know what's happening in the upper reaches of those paths.
So for people who don't know the area all that well, and maybe only have experience with East Coast roads, for instance, can you talk a little bit about the average opening date for the Going to the Sun Road? Like, what time you usually get this thing totally clear by?
Yeah, it usually opens mid to late June, and some, like, heavier snow years, it's pushed into July for sure, but it's very steep road. Like, it's wild to see a plow or an excavator in the middle of this like 2000 foot avalanche path on a, you know, 35 plus degree slope, like chiseling away at a giant pile of debris essentially. And a lot of the time when they're that exposed, we have to stand on the other side of the path where it's protected and watch them, or watch them from above and radio down if any snow starts moving down the path so they can back out of it.
So I guess this kind of yields the big question. How do you forecast an avalanche?
That's a great question that will probably pursue the rest of my life, or career rather, but you look
skiers at skiers everywhere, thank you.
You look at a lot of weather data and then you make sure that you're out in the snow as soon as it starts falling, essentially. And you just start tracking it, watching how that snowpack develops. Even though we're forecasting a lot of wet avalanches here because it's the spring, it's really important to know that whole season history and kind of know the structure of the snowpack and what happened during the winter. Because as water starts falling on it and percolating through the snow and hitting different layers, if you don't know whether those layers exist or where they are, then you're not going to be a very good forecaster for when things start going big, which I think they will this year because it's just been snowing and snowing more. Every other year I've been here, it's been a pretty solid spring snowpack by this time of year, and it's just quite a different beast this year, so it'll be interesting.
You mentioned like layers in the snowpack. Will you talk a little more about like what kind of layers present high risk to an avalanche and what you as a forecaster really want to look out for?
That's, it kind of depends on your location. But here in kind of the Intermountain West, we get a lot of like facet development where essentially, you know, we get long time periods without any snowfall, and essentially that surface snow gets really weak and then it gets buried, which causes avalanches, right? Right, especially as a loading event happens or a big storm. That's when we see big storm cycles, at least here in the winter. So, you know, that weakening can happen a lot of different ways, and it's been harder and harder. Like, obviously we work on weather models too. Like, we work off them trying to predict things, and it's, at least for me, in my small sample set of forecasting, I'm pretty young for a forecaster. It's getting harder and harder to align like all the models with what is actually happening with the weather. And we're getting a lot of weird weather events, like midwinter rain events, up to 9,000 feet here, right? Which produces essentially an ice layer in the middle of the snowpack, which then usually there'll be some facet development around that ice layer and then avalanches later. But more and more of these kind of like really interesting problems are happening.
I don't think so much about, when I think about snow in Montana, I don't think about midwinter rain events. I think, you know, I think the cold smoke, I think of the powdery, cold, dry snow. I mean, when I think of rain events, I think of where I'm from in California. We get big rain on snow events. But do you know if this is something that's been happening more as the planet and specifically the American West gets hotter?
I mean, I feel like I don't have a big enough sample size to say that, but at least in my career, which, you know, is going on around a decade now, it just seems to have more of these interesting midwinter events. Like, I met Phoebe in Boise, working for the NASA SnowX project, which is trying to remotely send snow from space, right? And during that winter there, they had a January wet slab event, which is really unheard of avalanche problem for that early in a season in a mountain climate, just due to rain.
And for folks who don't know who Phoebe is a mutual friend of Gabrielle's and I. Gabrielle knows her through Boise State. Phoebe and I were in Alaska together. She is one of the loveliest people in the world, and I hope that she hears this because I know it'll make her uncomfortable to hear that, but it's also true. I would love it if you could actually walk us through what the different kinds of avalanche problems are and why we think of avalanches in different problems as opposed to just sort of one thing.
Sure, yeah. So broadly, you have dry and wet avalanches, very broadly, and it kind of goes more specific from there. But with the climate, usually dry snow avalanches happen midwinter. Wet snow avalanches in most places happen in the spring. And we have, of those two categories, we have loose avalanches, like loose snow avalanches, which is essentially just the snow that's recently falling or has heated up in some way in the spring, that's just sliding downhill from one point and it accumulates a lot of mass. So that can cause a really big avalanche. Or we have slab avalanches, which is where there's a pretty continuous weak layer with a slab on top of it, which is, a slab is just like any amount of snow that acts as a cohesive unit. So broadly, anything hard snow related on any softer snow, like that's a slab avalanche. And those are the ones you see photos of that have crowns and very distinct lines, sharp edges, and those can cause usually a lot more damage too.
Yeah, I was gonna ask about that because obviously you hear stories about skiers where, you know, it's like, I got caught in an avalanche, bro, but like you're fine. And then you hear stories about skiers getting killed by avalanches. And so obviously there have to be factors aside from size of avalanche that make some avalanches just scary and some avalanches truly deadly and impossible to escape. And it would be great if you could talk a little bit about how you identify dangerous avalanche conditions and which of those types of avalanches you discussed is most likely to hurt someone and why.
That's a hard one because honestly, people have died in really, really small avalanches too, right? And that there's really not a silver bullet or like a rhyme or reason to, you know, more people are caught midwinter in avalanches because there are more skiers out, right? But people also die in these really weird ways and really slow avalanches. And I think, you know, a lot of weather there's a fatality or an injury is luck in an avalanche, right? Or you can just escape and have a learning lesson from it. Because it is a very harsh environment to learn lessons in, because you receive no feedback as a skier. You can make really bad decisions for many years and they will usually end in good skiing. And you can make really good decisions for a lot of years and that can end in good and bad skiing, right? So there's this feedback of getting away with things for a lot and not really knowing where your margins are and that kind of stuff. So I don't know if that helps answer your question. Like loose snow avalanches are usually less consequential. They're usually a lot smaller, and it really just depends on the terrain you're in, right? Because if you're in open terrain and a loose snow avalanche happens, it doesn't pose much of a threat to you. But if you're in consequential terrain over cliffs and a little bit of loose snow moves and kind of like sets you off your feet and you fall. So it's kind of dictated more by the terrain, I think.
Actually, that leads me to another sort of question with regards to terrain traps. If you see warming temperatures and tree line expanding upwards as sort of an expansion of hazardous terrain traps going forward?
I'm thinking about more what I see in Montana is a lot of like high alpine tree die off.
Really?
Yeah, of like, you know, if there's not enough water in seasons, or we have like pine beetle all around the west that's killing white bark pine. And that's an upper elevation tree. But trees do provide, you know, clues for skiers, at least, of how to get up things or how to do that. I bet it's probably becoming more densely vegetated there. And that could lead to more issues, but that's such a long process that I feel like people would be able to adapt to that. The forest thing is really interesting because the more fires there are and the more ash, if the wind blows through a burned forest and strips a lot of ash off and lays it down on the snow because it's black, it absorbs a lot of heat all winter and it'll melt off a lot faster. The same with dust. So stuff like that's happening all around in forests too.
So do you know if snow that's been covered in fire in black carbon in dust changes the conditions of that snow to the point that it affects avalanche risk at all? Or is that purely speculative?
That is purely speculative, but a lot of people talk about it. It's like someone else's master's thesis for the future, I think, to see, because it definitely affects it, right? It's just not been studied thoroughly enough to know like how do all the chemicals in the air that get ingrained into a cloud, that snow like nucleates in a cloud, like how does that affect the snow, right? All these chemicals that are in our air are part of snow nucleation now, and that affects like crystal structure of snow.
So you're working on a master's too, right? Or are you working on a PhD?
Been working on a master's forever because I work full time all winter, but that's the part where I'm writing my thesis, and mine was just about, it was centered on a snowtell site, which is just a telemetry station for measuring snow. And they have them all over the West, essentially for water runoff in the spring, but avalanche forecasters use them too, because they're very handy to have an alpine station that's monitoring snowfall, right? And I just noticed that one around Bozeman underreported by about half, just because it was installed in the 70s and the trees grew around it and shielded a lot. So I just studied kind of snowfall patterns around that snowtell and sort of modeled what the actual snowfall would be in this canyon based on all these point measurements.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about that. I mean, my experience with snowtell has mostly been from the drought-stricken California area. They provide vital information for water supply. Talk a little bit about both the ways in which avalanche forecasters use snowtell, but also like the potential implications of the snowtell data being wrong. How does that affect your work? And how does that also affect like water planning?
Both, you know, hydrological forecasters and avalanche forecasters rely on snowtell data, which will be like, for an avalanche forecaster, they look at the SWE, or the snow water equivalent, right? Which is just how much water is in that snow. And they'll look at like the height of new snow. And from that, you can kind of figure out how dense the snow is, right? So they look at that. And if that's wrong, and if you're forecasting for an avalanche hazard and you have a really tricky hazard, then your snowtell says, oh, there's only 6 inches of snow. But then I go ski there and there's over a foot of snow. That's quite a different hazard, right? That's just more weight, essentially. I'm stressing that snowpack, if it has a weak layer, the more water there is or the more snowfall. And then the same with if I'm forecasting for how much water to let out of a reservoir for a city, right? Timed at a certain time. And I think, you know, there's only so much snowfall up here and I have to time it at these times. I could just be missing really how much water is there. And by missing that, you're missing like how to time it for the valley below too.
Is that sort of an endemic problem or is it a problem that you found locally? And what's the solution?
It's a problem at several snowtells that I know of in Montana, and I only have experience with those. I think it's really an effective network for sure, because without those, and they cost like hundreds of thousands of dollars to maintain by the NRCS, but without those, we would have no data. So they're really nice to have that. And also all the models that are used for hydrological forecasting or for avalanche forecasting are forced with that data, right? So without that data, they would just have nothing. Solution to that. I know that in some areas, like in California and Washington, the rain line is rising as well. So your snowtell station is no longer in a place that receives much snowfall, which is a problem too. The solution is, I've had friends that make really tiny mobile weather stations that are quite cheap with just like a Raspberry Pi processor. And they just program it to measure certain things, but they need cell service usually. But I think the solution is just have a bunch of those. And for an avalanche center, you just like place them all these places that, you know, historically would be good areas or are data sparse for you. And then there's also like community obs, like snow community obs. So there's apps now where if you dig a snow pit and you enter in data into the system, it catalogs it with everyone's data from that area. And that helps the model snow in that area a lot better too. So as skiers, we can help with that by just, you know, depth probing snow in the winter.
Yeah. And I guess actually that leads me to a different question I had regarding the differences between avalanche forecasting in the United States and in Canada. Because one of the things that you'll see if you log on to avalanche.ca is that the community of forecasts, the community observations are very easily integrated into the interface. And you know, it's a nationally funded program in a way that it's not in the US. And I'm curious about, you know, you're up there in Glacier. I don't know how much you talk to the folks in Alberta. But I'm curious about if you sort of see any differences between sort of the American model where it's national forest by national forest versus the Canadian model that's a little more federally funded, a little more entrenched, perhaps. And if you see sort of the American side of things going that way, particularly after how deadly not this past season has been, but the season before.
Yeah, I can't say I have a large amount of experience with the Canadian stuff, but I do know that, yeah, it's way more developed, right? It's way better funded, which is huge. Like, I think all the Forest Service avalanche centers maybe have like $1 million between mall.
Jesus.
They're just not really well funded by the Forest Service, right? Because A, the Forest Service is strapped for money too, and it only gets so much, and all these other departments compete for it, and there are only so many recreational skiers, right? So even though there was that 2020 and the year of really high fatalities, I don't know. I just don't think that that will change anytime soon. It is nice to see Avalanche Centers expanding and hiring more employees, because those forecasters have a really hard job. Like, it's wild to see, you know, three people forecasting for a huge area and just like working every day, these like hours where you get up at 3, you're in the office by 4, and then you get back to the office at 4, and then you put in your obs and it's 6 p.m. and then you wake up, go to sleep so you can wake up and do it again.
That's insane. Is that what your schedule is like? Can you tell us a little bit more about what you do as an avalanche forecaster, like what your day-to-day routine looks like?
Yeah. Yeah, it's about like that. on days I forecast, I get before, they house me in West Glacier at the National Park Service headquarters, which is really nice because the closest town is maybe like a 40-minute drive. So I wake up and then I bike over to the office. Then I spend an hour just hunkered down, listening to music and just trying to figure out weather models and filling out all this weather data, kind of putting together conceptually what I think the day is going to be like. And then I write a forecast with the hazard, the weather for the day, so that the crew of people that I'm working with kind of knows what to expect. And then by 6, I go to the meeting with anyone who's going to be working on the road, and I tell them the forecast, what we're going to do, and then I get all my ski stuff ready. And usually the other forecaster goes with me. I'm really lucky to work with two other guys that are great. And so we usually do 2 days on, 2 or 3 days on forecasting. And then the other 2 days of the week, we are the other forecaster's partner. So we get to sleep until 5, which is really nice.
So 5 a.m. is considered sleeping in?
Yeah.
I'll add this to jobs I could never do.
Sky, you and Alpine Starts, man. You're never gonna summit Everest like this.
Damn, there go all my dreams.
He doesn't want to. So actually, that does lead me to another question. Is there a difference in how you write a forecast and how you think about a forecast for a crew that's clearing snow versus a recreational avalanche forecast?
Oh gosh, that's a great question. That's actually what I've been struggling most with this week is, for this job, you have to forecast for someone in a plow, in a giant like plow or an excavator, all of this big equipment, like a rotary for snow. And so it's really fascinating to be like, last week I was writing about Winds Labs, and the person who heads the program here was like, I've never seen a wind slab hit the road. Like, that would be anomalous. You're writing for rec users. So I was like, okay, I got to dial it. It's really fascinating because we go out and ski in it though. So it's weird to have the mindset of like, okay, I'm writing low danger. I'm writing low danger because I think the odds of a really large avalanche happening are low. But I can go out and be skiing around in these pads and be like remote triggering little avalanches with this fresh snowfall, or like, you know, there are avalanches that I could trigger that are very capable of harming me, right? But they will never harm the plow. So it's really fascinating to be moving that environment, but like forecasting, okay, it's low danger for the whole crew, but not for all the skiers or the three of us up there.
So I've got to ask, actually, speaking of skiing around, about your setup. I think is that a pair of Wale, like, is that like V8s or like Hypervectors and like a DPS like Freebird? Black Crows, Black Crows.
Just to clarify, Samuel's talking about skis here. He knows all the exact models, but didn't think to say skis. He got into skiing like a year ago.
Right? I don't know all the exact models. I'm sure Gabriel knows many more of the exact models than I do.
Samuel got into skiing like a year ago, and in the course of a year, he's made himself like an expert in backcountry skiing.
Oh, God, no. That is not true. I have no ARE certifications. I'm still figuring out how to use a transceiver. Do not say I'm an expert in backcountry skiing.
But you know a lot about, like, how to look at safety and stuff like that.
I don't know nearly as much as Gabrielle, so I'm more curious about what she has to say about it.
Everyone starts somewhere.
But this is to say, is that a pair of black crows and a pair of Wallace?
Yeah, I have a pair of atomic backlands that I rode today that are outside drying. Then I have some black crow orbs and then the Valet hypervectors.
Nice. Do you have tele bindings on the Valets?
I don't. Everything's got just touring.
Fair enough. For those who aren't familiar with the backcountry ski world, there's a form of skiing called telemarking that has been described as like driving a manual car. It's less efficient, more difficult, not as safe, and altogether has no particular reason to exist in modern society, and yet we still do it because we love it. But for somebody who's an actual professional like Gabrielle is, I think probably AT Alpine Touring is the way to go.
It's lighter.
Oh, yeah. And it's probably a lot nicer when you have a pack on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when you guys are going in today, are you skinning up? Are you going in under your own power, or are you going up with the crews?
So it's a really long road. We drive maybe 40 minutes to get to where the last plow mark is. And then there's obviously like a 10-foot berm of snow where they stopped, right? And so we'll park where the road crew can get all their equipment by. And then we start skinning from there. And I mean, the paths are, you know, 2,000 feet above them, right? And the road just kind of side cuts this huge steep, all of these huge steep slopes to Logan Pass. So we go, it's usually ski cramponing from the car because it's
that icy.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It is pretty in spots, pretty absurdly consequential no fall, like skinning and skiing terrain for us. So we skin up into a path and it depends on the day. Maybe we want to just spot for them from up high. So we have a radio, right? And we'll watch certain paths, or what happens here is glide cracks open up above the road, which is terrifying.
For people who don't know, can you tell us what a glide crack is?
Yeah, a glide crack is essentially the entirety of the snowpack being pulled down by gravity and moving on the ground. And usually it happens on like grass or rock faces. And it's when liquid water is essentially lubricating the ground. And these avalanches like start as little cracks and then they can all just fracture at once, right? And so it's nice because here there's an extensive history of what cracks and avalanches and what doesn't, but you're like, you never really know. So it's just all these glide cracks will be above this guy, you know, in this tiny plow, plowing the road. So
I actually one of the things that I'm also curious about is when you're going up, how often are you digging pits? Where are you choosing to dig your pits? Is that the still, you know, with all the weather models you're looking at, are you using pits to ground truth or are you using pits to forecast?
Oh, we use them still, yeah. Even though it's a spring snowpack, to forecast, because what happens in the spring with wet avalanches, right, or any time you have any solar input onto the snow, water starts moving in the snowpack. And you really want to know the structure, especially, you know, it's snowed the last 2 weeks I was here and essentially laid down a brand new, like half of a snowpack on top of this really hard, you know, spring snow surface. So it's been interesting to dig, not full depth, because that would be like 3 meters here, but dig in the top meter and look for different sun crusts and different layers that were buried really recently that we think as soon as it starts really heating up here, those top layers might wet slap, right? And that's because water percolates down through snow until it hits usually like an ice crust or a change in density of the snow particle. And then it just kind of sits in that layer and it'll run on that. And so it requires that liquid water input with these wet slab or wet loose avalanches, the same with glide. But they're very hard to forecast for because they're very unpredictable. Because how do you quantify or try to conceptualize as a forecaster how much water is moving in the snowpack and where. And the best we can do is try to time it. There's historical glide avalanches here that are like 50 foot deep cracks that happen every year around the same time. And so usually once those start opening up, it gives you clues as to like the timing of when all the stuff above the road might go.
When you start to see like avalanche conditions starting to form, or when you're looking at conditions either on the ground or with weather models and thinking, wow, this looks like there could be an avalanche, this looks dangerous, how long in advance are you usually able to forecast those conditions? And then how do you get the message out? So how do you make sure that people who are thinking about skiing actually hear that there's avalanche danger? And how far in advance can you predict that?
I think like, from the recreational forecasting standpoint, they just get it out in the morning, right? And the same with here, like forecasting for the road, we just call it high danger and then no one gets to go up the road. Closed. So it's closed. We make the call when people who are working on the road can be on the road and when they can't. And I think the harder part has been when we don't work on the weekend and it's starting to heat up a lot, this road is open to bikers. And they love just biking up to where all the plow crew stuff is parked from the week of work. And so you'll come up here on a really hot weekend and there'll just be all these tourists biking this, going this on road. And it's beautiful to bike. But as a forecaster, somewhere inside of you, you're like, they have no idea they're below like all of this stuff. There have been people caught on the uphill side of the road and turn back around to bike down and the road is blocked by an avalanche and they have to be rescued from the other side of the road. So in your mind as a forecaster, like there's only a matter of time before someone gets caught, right?
Are you, when an accident happens, are you called into action as part of a rescue team? And if so, what's that look like?
I think here, probably not. What our call as the forecaster is to make the call whether the plow can start working on that to get the people out or whether the rangers can go across certain paths to go get someone. So we'll look at the weather, if people are caught, and we'll obviously help if we're needed and go up there and be a part of that. But our primary role, I think, is to just be there on site and be aware of what's happening on the snow and be able to direct people helping with a rescue as to whether it's safe for them to be there or not.
And I guess my other question on that is, when you were working at Gallatin, is that sort of the same deal, or is it different when you're working in a National Forest Avalanche Center for a recreational forecast?
I think at the GNFAC, and I was only intern there for 1 year, but they are called in for incidents and burials and that kind of thing to help with that. I think in most recreational forecast avalanche centers, if there's a burial, they call.
So in the event of a burial, in the event of an avalanche where people are trapped, I know Samuel was trying to describe the other day a little bit about what this looks like, but I would love to hear from you, like, how do you deal with that sort of situation? Not you personally, Gabrielle, but like, how does a rescue team save someone from an avalanche? And what does that usually look like?
I would say if a rescue team is involved, that person is probably not alive. If a SAR team is called for something, unless they've been dug out by their partner, because usually, right, we ski with a partner with a beacon. And if they're able to get them out and call for help, that's great. Right, that's when a SAR team can go in and call or and assist with them, and usually that's like a helicopter assisted thing if you're not in a national park. I think here they would try to get someone out other ways, but in the event of any emergency, right, a helicopter is a great tool.
I think maybe what Sky was asking about a little as well was the actual process of using a transceiver and a probe to find a buried victim.
Oh, yeah, I think the key part to that is that those are, you know, those are tools that require practice. And if you practice enough, it becomes almost just like second nature to do what you want it to be, because that situation is already going to be very stressful. So in the event of a burial, right, we do a beacon search where we get a signal, we do a core search and then a find search, which are just terms I'm going to throw at you. Just getting, it's almost like searching for someone on a macro level. And then once you get, you know, close to them in meterage, you really try to dial in on that lowest number, because that's very, very important to getting a probe strike. Getting out your probe, probing for them, leaving your probe in if you get a probe strike, and then digging them out.
How long are these probes? Like how prepared, like to what depth are you prepared for someone being buried in the snow? How deep do you dig in an avalanche?
I think you dig until you find them. In a train trap, right? With not a lot of snow. If someone falls with an avalanche into a train trap, that's, you know, a couple feet of snow breaking up high. If it's funneled into a really narrow area, right? That person can be under like 6 feet of snow. And the avalanche was, you know, a foot maybe or less.
When we were up in Alaska, we were carrying 3-meter probes with us.
Yes, same.
That's kind of the standard.
Yeah, longer the better, which people try to shave weight in their pack by like getting those really short probes. Don't do that.
Fast and lighting someplace with avalanche terrain feels like a bad choice.
Although I gotta say, walking through snow, especially at high elevation, that is like draining. I can see the impulse behind why someone might want to be like, I don't want to carry too much weight. How likely is it that there's going to be an avalanche anyway? I mean, how many people die of avalanches every year?
Well, it depends on
how many people die of avalanches every year.
It depends on the year. And actually, I was hoping we could get into that. The question of there's been an influx of backcountry skiers who, you know, were both previously resort skiers and who may not necessarily have skied all that much in the past anyways, for a variety of factors ranging from the pandemic to changing snow conditions at resorts, leading to better snow conditions in the backcountry compared to resorts, people going further, going harder, going bigger. And also, I would probably argue, the proliferation of social media, but that's a thing that I have to do that has to do with my own hangups. For those of our listeners who don't know, the 2020-2021 avalanche season was one of the deadliest in the United States in a very long time. And one of the things that actually has been good to see is that this year's season has been far less deadly. And I'm wondering if you think that if there has been better education over the past, and I know it's a very small sample size since the beginning of the pandemic, but if there's been better education since the beginning of the pandemic, if there's been more of an influx of backcountry skiers who are going and taking the air avalanche education courses, or if you think we just got lucky this year.
I teach avalanche education, so I'm a full proponent of more knowledge is better for people. I think that season was really interesting from a COVID standpoint and from so many new users entering the backcountry. And I totally agree with your social media thing, by the way. I think that's a huge part of this social facilitation of what it is to be a backcountry skier, because I do feel like people are really motivated to learn, and more people are signing up for avalanche education, right? But I think it's important to instill this process that's behind like all of these ski films and every Instagram post and whatever else. Like, even as an avalanche professional, you know, no one operates in this medium perfectly ever. Like, everyone gets in near misses, you know, that's kind of just the nature of it. And it's more about like having the sort of humility in the mountains to really learn from your lessons that you're seeing, or really be able to take time with gaining knowledge. Like, people really want to be like, I'll check this box and get this cert. And then the next year I'll get this one. And then like, I'll be good. You're like, ah, it takes a long time and a lot of walking around and a lot of failing on things that you want to ski to really learn about snow really well. Like, to me, there's a huge difference between people that ski well and ski a lot and post a lot of cool things they're skiing and someone who actually like fundamentally skis and understands snow and has a process for that that's logical and makes sense. Like, I always hear, you know, if I tour with people I don't tour with a lot, you're like, okay, you know, like, how does this snow look? And it'll be somewhere neither of us have been, and they'll be like, feels good. And like, why? Why? Like, having this logical, you know, I really, like, anyone I teach, I really want to instill that, like, it's really good to take time with this stuff and make sure your process of learning is slow. But no one likes the slow process.
And I think we'd also love to talk a little more about how you got to where you are as somebody who, you know, has years of experience and where you started and where did you start getting into the backcountry and what made you make that switch? And then I think probably I want to ask about what got you interested in avalanches specifically.
I grew up skiing, but I didn't backcountry ski until my 20s. And I just, honestly, it was just luck, like living in Bozeman. At that point in time, I was able to meet some really good mentors. And I honestly think mentorship is the fundamental point where someone like can branch off and become, go from like a recreational backcountry user to more of like a professional. I think it requires mentorship because they point out things that like you don't even know to look for. Like, you're not even seeing it. And someone's like, oh, what about that? And you're like, whoa, I never even knew that could be a thing. Right. So it requires that feedback process and a lot of time. So, you know, in my earlier 20s, I just started backcountry skiing more. And then I got involved at the Avalanche Center and was submitting observations to them a lot. So they got to know my name. And then I went to pro development seminars and it kind of just snowballed from there. I mean, I volunteered, honestly, a lot of my time with people to show them that I was really motivated to learn about this medium. And avalanches are fascinating, right? Like, it's really cool to A, be able to walk to all these places that most people don't see. And then skiing's just very fun. And then the other part is like watching the process of a snowpack develop in a mountain range and like knowing it very intimately and kind of like testing your own knowledge of prediction and then seeing these massive avalanches when you expect them and then seeing massive avalanches when you don't expect them helps you get that process dialed. And they're just, yeah, I mean, it's cool to, avalanches are the only natural disaster essentially or phenomena that humans trigger. I mean, we can't trigger a hurricane necessarily.
Exactly. We can definitely trigger a wildfire, but
yeah, that's true too.
You've talked about rain on snow events, but do you see climate change fundamentally changing the way that avalanche cycles work going forward, or do you just sort of see, as we've seen in every other sort of natural disaster, a randomness and a hugeness of scale injected into the avalanche cycle that may not necessarily have been present in the past?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just getting harder and harder. You know, it's, as we know, it's getting harder and harder to predict weather in itself, right? And being the people that rely on the downstream weather, like, it is thusly harder and harder to predict all these avalanche problems, right? And with really weird winters, that are warmer in some places, or in California when it's like dry, 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 and then it snows 6 feet in one storm and that's your snowpack for the year. I mean, these things happen as anomalies and they've happened as anomalies in the past. And I think the next decade will be really interesting to see what happens both in fire season, like the melt season for snow is really integral to what happens in the fire season. So it's tied to summer too, but I think it'll be really interesting to see you know, are we settling into a new pattern, or is this totally all over the place? Like, patterns are all just going to be way less predictable, so there's no pattern. It'll be interesting to see that, I think, if that answers that question.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, as climate change has more and more of an effect on this field of work, part of the reason we were so eager to interview you is that you're both a professional avalanche forecaster and a scientist. You know, you're working on your graduate degree in snow science. Do you feel that that makes you unique within your field? Like, are there a lot of other people with masters or PhDs who are like scientists and also forecasters? And also within your field, is there like a gender dynamic? Like, I know in a lot of science, it's like a very male dominated field. And I'm wondering if as a woman in a scientific career, you've encountered that.
Yeah, definitely. I think there are quite a few, especially coming out of MSU, like forecasters, avalanche forecasters that have master's degrees from there, which is cool, because then those avalanche centers usually like put out some form of research, which is cool to see too. And I'd say more as you edge into the PhD realm, you get, because of the nature of the careers, like less tied to the snow as a medium and more tied to just like the academia side of things. So there is some overlap. And as you get broader into like the cryosphere and snow hydrology stuff, you know, obviously you get less and less people that actually like spend time in snow.
That's too bad.
Mm.
It's like musicians who study music without like playing it or something.
Totally.
You're really coming for me right now.
You study snow and play in it.
I only in a good snow year. In a bad snow year, we're just stuck on blue ice. So that, I think, and on the second half of that question Sky asked, do you find that there is within avalanche forecasting a gender divide? Because obviously mountaineering and professional skiing has been kind of a male-dominated field for a long time. Is that something that you found has existed? Is it something that's been challenging, or has it just not been an issue?
Yeah, it's definitely a thing. Yeah, and it is challenging. Yeah. It's just a fascinating dynamic to be involved with, because I had an undergrad in cell biology and I worked in a hospital thinking that like, oh, I'm like going to be a doctor and there are actually more women now in medicine. And then I felt it would be very similar entering this career. But it is, you know, snow science started in like the 40s or 50s here in the US, right? So young. And it is totally like male dominated, right? Which can be good and bad. And it's bad when it's a culture of gatekeeping, right? And it's good when you have really like good mentorship. There are few, like a handful of women out there that are great and are older than me and have mentored me. And I try to really like do the same to women that are entering their career too. Like the coolest part that I've had of teaching like professional one courses for avalanche education is like really getting to know some of the up and coming women and kind of doing whatever I can to help them along, whether it's like a recommendation or whatever extra feedback on things. You're like, that's my role now, is to like, you know, be the shoulders that someone else can stand on, right? Because I had to essentially fight my way here. You're like, I don't want someone to go through the same process. I want it to be easier for them. But that's definitely been a thing. And then the benefit to that though is you add diversity to a crew, right? If you're hired on and I'm the only woman working here, I'm the first woman to forecast for the road here and for the National Park Service, which is kind of weird too, but
that's insane.
Yeah, I mean, you add diversity to that group too, so I think that's good, and that's good for them to experience.
sort of the last couple questions that I have that don't involve getting into the physics of faceting, because I think that's probably not where Sky wants this to go.
Hey, I mean, if we had all the time in the world.
Is if people want to get more involved with Avalanche, you know, educate themselves regarding avalanches, educate themselves regarding backcountry skiing, where's the best place for them to go?
They can go to avalanche.org, which I think is it has a big map of all of the avalanche centers in the US. So that's a really easy way to identify the one that's closest to you. And then, you know, the way I started, honestly, was skiing a lot. And then I wrote down what I skied a lot and really like tracked myself of what I was seeing every year. And then I also just read a lot of books, like Staying Alive and Avalanche Terrain, all those like avalanche basics books, getting really interested in those. And with, you know, everything that's online with the internet, there's so many cool videos from snow and avalanche workshops that exist that you can go and listen to. And it's really just like being a sponge for as much information as you can, and then taking that out and being okay with walking around on your skins, going up to something, being like, oh, I'm not very sure, and then like skidding back out to your car and being like, that was a great day. Like, you know, there's always something to learn in there. The snow is changing constantly every day, and if you go out for 2 days in a row and you don't notice anything different, you just need to look harder.
I feel like, especially in the spring, as you know, the melt is going on in earnest, it's just like you can get feet and feet of snow, and then the next day it's like totally different.
Totally. Yeah.
Do you see, like, sorry, do you have like future plans or like career plan? I don't know how to ask this in a way that seems like a normal human.
Are you
going to
avalanche forecast until you die of old age peacefully?
That would be great. Yeah, I don't know. I really enjoy it. It's a really stressful job, and it's physically hard too. And so that, like, as I've like in my early 30s now, I'm like, oh no, I really like being lazy sometimes. Like, I really love sleeping in now. Like, okay, sustainably. Yeah, I want to continue a career for 2 decades more, right? And whether I dovetail that in with maybe more like curriculum development for avalanche education or changing that, because I see a lot of growth in ways that could be better. You're like, okay, you know, maybe I could make something in that realm and then have, you know, some forecasting like this that keeps your brain sort of in that medium, right? Like, I think if you just totally go try to stay in the snow world, but in like a computer job fully, like you lose touch with what's really happening with it and the medium that you're trying to understand. So I think having both is where I want to stay, but I'm just not sure yet what that looks like.
Well, actually, you know what? That does lead us into a different thing that we did want to bring up. What do you think the future of avalanche education looks like as cryospheric sciences become increasingly, you know, you were talking about working with SnowX, become increasingly tied in with remote sensing for reasons of both cost efficiency and as well as safety. And because of that, even places where you may not necessarily need remote sensing as your primary tool, remote sensing has grown and evolved and grown more powerful. Do you see the future of avalanche forecasting remaining a woman on the ground sort of job, or do you see it sort of in a lot of the same way that for me glaciology is becoming more and more a remote sensing based field? Do you see it changing the same way?
Yeah, I do. I think it will get better. I think you'll still need the forecaster, because it, like we see how off those models can be and how wrong they can be sometimes, and you sort of need the human there to, you know, look at all the different data outputs and integrate that together still, I think, because there's just so much nuance to terrain in the mountains and how weather flows over it. Like, I just don't think that will be an issue for that. I think it will get better though, because you'll have more data points, and being able to like validate how you're forecasting would be really cool too. Like remote sensing, you know, avalanches after you forecast a high, and then a satellite flies over and you see all these avalanches. Like, cool, that's really good feedback that I made the right call for that. So I think that will change and the data will get better, hopefully.
Well, here's hoping that no matter how good the data gets, there'll always still be a reason for on-the-ground avalanche forecasters to have fun in the snow.
Well, here's hoping there's enough snow to keep having fun in.
There we go. That's what I was going to say, too. Yeah.
Do we want to call it
episode? I think we might call it an episode. I think with that, Gabrielle, thank you so much for being here. We've had a lovely time talking to you. We'd love to know if there's, you know, if there's anything else you want to say before we sign off. But the one thing that I think I want to say is at the beginning of this episode, I called you a badass and you demurred. And I'd like to think that by the end of this episode, whatever you may say, you've proven me right.
thank you, guys. No, it was really fun to chat. I appreciate the time.